This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Well, fall is a great time to escape with a book, and the pandemic is a good reason, too. If you have kids at home looking for adventure, you might want to check out Duluth author Margie Preuss. The award-winning New York Times best-selling author writes for kids, middle schoolers, and young adults. Preuss recently visited with our Ashley Thornburg about her new mystery, The Silver Box.
Margie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this book, it's the final in the Enchantment Lake mystery series. Your heroine, Francie, a resourceful teen trying to unravel the mystery of her mother's disappearance. How do you describe Francie?
Francie is, the shortest and probably most succinct way of describing her is as a Northwoods Nancy Drew. She's 17. She's very independent. She lives by herself, actually, in this book. And she is quite bold and quite impulsive. She makes a lot of quick decisions that aren't always the smartest.
Was she a teenager? What?
I have a friend who doesn't have any kids and says, I just can't believe that she does these stupid things. And I said, oh, you haven't had teenagers. But she really gets herself entangled in some scary situations. But she's quite resourceful. She seems to always get herself out of these predicaments. So all of these stories take place on a semi-fictional northern Minnesota lake. And I think your listeners probably are familiar with the scenes of swimming, boating, berry picking, swarms of mosquitoes.
The state bird, yes.
Yeah, poisoned hot dishes, exploding bulldozers, and, murder. So kind of typical northern Minnesota lake life.
Yeah, your average Saturday, there's a murder, right? Yeah.
But yeah, and each book takes place in a different season. So Enchantment Lake, the first book, was in the summer, and The Clue in the Trees is in the fall. And Francie goes to school in a small northern Minnesota town. For the first time ever, she has lived most of her life in New York City. So it's a little bit of a culture shock. But she finds what I really like about it is she finds that there is a lot of excitement to be had and a lot of fun and a lot of also danger for her. So it's definitely not boring. And then this last book takes place in the winter. And so originally I thought I would write a fourth book, which would take place in the spring.
Yeah.
But if you spent a so-called spring in northern Minnesota, you know that there really kind of isn't one.
It's about 4 days.
Right. In my book, it's like one chapter. So there's one chapter at the very end that's spring, and that seems like about the right amount of spring for these books. So,
what is it about the age group of the characters in the book? Francie and her cohorts, Raven, Theo, Jay, they're all in that. I don't know if precocious, you can still use that word and apply it to teenagers, but it's a very difficult age to navigate, especially for as a girl becomes a woman and she's doing this without her mother.
Yeah, and she does long for a mother. I mean, she's a little bit jealous of her friend Raven, whose mother makes her homemade lunches, to take to school, and homemade bread and things like that. And she sort of fantasizes what that would be like to have a mother like that. And so she does miss the mother, but she has lived so long with so much independence that, it's almost... that it would never really work. But they're all pretty independent kids. Of course, a lot of that is for the fun of reading when you're when you're 10, 11, 12 years old to read
Yeah.
about older kids
Right.
having these adventures and doing all these things by themselves. And I think there's a lot of kind of fascination with that. And that was part of always what I liked about reading Nancy Drew. You know, I probably read those books when I was 10 or 11, but she's old. She drives a roadster. You know, she has a boyfriend in college. So it just felt really like I was really getting in the know with what these older kids are doing. So, you know, I think some of it is that fun. And I grew up loving Pippi Longstocking, and I know a lot of kids don't read that anymore, which is sad because I think those are fabulous books. And she's, you know, Pippi lives alone in a big house with her horse and her monkey, in the house with her. And I think that also had an influence on me with that kind of independence and resourcefulness of a kid just doing things on their own without their parents, you know. Also, I think I had a lot of independence as a kid. I was the last of six, and
Oh,
my parents were very
they were
busy,
tired.
and yeah, and they kind of ignored me, I think. So I guess some of it's my own experience. Oh, and definitely my own experience having spent all of my summers growing up at a cabin on a lake, where my cousins and I just roamed around like little stray dogs. We were given a lot of freedom, and you know, there's something very magical about those years.
Come home at sunset, you know, or when you hear a
That's right,
dinner
yeah.
bell.
Right, the dinner bell. Yep.
Well, the book is very much infused with a love of adventure and a love of the land, and very specifically that heavily forested, lots of lake land. And you mentioned you grew up with that classic roam around the woods, find your way to the cabin, maybe you eat some berries and find out if they're poisonous or not. What do you feel when you're in those woods, when you're near one of those lakes?
Yeah, I feel those. Well, I live in Duluth now, and so very, very near a very large lake, and many other northern lakes as well, and you know, up the North Shore and the Gunflint Trail, and I feel that very at home in this country. I also feel pretty at home in Western Minnesota because I grew up in Fergus Falls. So not far from Fargo. And my aunt and uncle lived in Fargo when I was a kid, and I used to take the train. This is really going to tell people how old I am. To go visit my cousins in Fargo. So that is a part of the state that I also know quite well too and feel at home in. But yeah, the heavily forested, very water-rich areas of northern Minnesota really feel like home to me. And I would say that this lake is a kind of amalgam of the lake at which I grew up and where I still have a cabin of my own, and friends' places near Ely or up the Gunflint Trail or way up on Rainy Lake, all of which I've spent time on those different lakes at those different cabins. And so each one has its kind of charm and its issues. I mean, these books do delve into some of the issues we face in this part of the world, and I've kind of made them all happen in
In
this
this
one
one
area,
book.
but this one
Well,
mythical
yeah,
place.
let's talk about those areas because we're talking about the forests and the lakes, but it's also the Iron Range, and it's also an area where there is a lot of potential for copper and nickel mining. And of course, people talk about the Boundary Waters area as being the largest protected area away from motorboats, away from noise, an area. It was recently named one of the most relaxing places on Earth. I'm also hovering over some unemployment data on the MN.gov website, and it's definitely a part of the state where unemployment is about double what it is where I am in the Fargo-Moorhead area. And the book, without giving away too much of what's happening in the book, of course, but it does talk about the nature and protecting the nature and also finding that balance of having jobs in this area so that people can have an income.
Right. Well, I try to put both arguments out there, you know. So my goal when I write for kids is not to answer questions so much as to raise them and let the reader ponder and think about some of the questions that are raised. And for me, a lot of these issues are questions I, you know, might have my own attitudes about them, but in the story, I try to have my characters have their own attitudes and their own feelings about them. And it, that's a way to show both sides of an issue. Mm-hmm. And I just put it out there. And young people can learn more, you know, if they get curious. They can try and find out more about what this means for the area and make their own decisions, really. That's what I hope they do.
Does that show up ever in, I'm sure you're not doing it a lot in person this year, but the visits to schools? I know you've done some work virtually this year and you have traveled a lot around speaking to schools. Does that come up in conversation a lot?
You know, that's interesting. I don't recall, I'm trying to think, I think that, you know, they get pretty involved in the story and they, you know, they have questions that they want answered about, you know, what happens to Francie and does she ever find her mom and, you know,
read the books.
What's going to happen in the next book and things like that. So I don't really remember having conversations about that. And I'm kind of grateful because I don't really want to get in into trouble with the schools, but but I hope that they do think about it at least and talk about it with each other as well, you know, like maybe they have a conversation. That would be my desire, is that kids would talk about the book with each other.
Yeah. Do you hear that kind of feedback from teachers?
Yeah, you know, I found it interesting that I have talked to teachers who've used it in their classroom because it has Minnesota history in it. And I thought, really? Like, does it? And, you know, they want to include, or they need to, maybe for curricular reasons, books that have contain something about Minnesota history. And I hadn't really thought about that, but for instance, The Clue in the Trees really deals with some of the history in Minnesota, like gold mining, which, you know, that was kind of an eye-opening thing even for me to find out that gold mining was really there was a boom in northern Minnesota back in the, well, I don't really remember the date, but it was before iron ore was discovered, that, and there was some gold, and, you know, everybody thought it was going to be the new, you know, San Francisco, but that didn't happen. And bootlegging is another thing that happened in northern Minnesota along the border of Canada, and that plays a part in that second book. So, yeah, there are aspects of Minnesota history in the book, in all three of the books, but maybe the second one might have the most. I don't know. I'd have to read them all again.
Yeah, but, do you ever run into that where a kid or a teacher remembers something that you are just like, oh, I don't remember doing that.
Yes, it's very embarrassing. Yeah, I had a student ask me in a big assembly about something, and I had
Oh
no
no.
idea. I was like, what? Finally, the teacher had to kind of describe the whole scene to me. And then I'm like, oh, just dredge it up from my memory. Yeah, it's awkward. And sometimes I can't remember the characters' names either. I mean, I remember my protagonist's names, but some of the secondary characters elude me.
What's your writing process?
Panic.
I get that. I work in a deadline-oriented field because otherwise I would get nothing done.
Yes, a deadline definitely does, spur one on. I don't, it's very hard to talk about my process because it's very messy. I've just been lately saying it's like flailing. I just kind of write things down and hope that somehow these things are going to connect some way. I don't write an outline. I tr always try to write an outline, and I get like one or two points done, and then I just start writing a scene. Which is okay. It's like, well, that got me going on this scene, so I guess it was effective, you know. I don't write in order necessarily, like chapter one and, through. And I don't really even think about chapters until well into writing it. I do meet with a writing group, and one somebody asked me once, like, well, now, what is this, the end of the chapter? I'm like, I don't know. I figured that out later, So everything just kind of, I just have to have a lot of faith that it's all going to come together somehow.
That's the editor's job, right?
Well, no.
No. Oh,
They
shoot.
don't think so. No. I mean, they will, once you think you have it all together and you're pretty sure it's final and needs no improvement, that's when the editor comes in and tells you, no,
You
you
need
need a
some
lot
more
of improvement. So,
improvement.
yeah.
Is that for you, is that a scary point when you're handing it over to the editor, or is it more relief?
Well, no, it can be very scary because you can have a very negative reaction, where you either are told you have to go back to the drawing board, or I'm, don't want this, which has happened to me. Some people think that once you're published, you're in, and every book thereafter is going to be published, and it's not like that at all. People I know have been very surprised to find out that I continue to get rejections on books, and I do. I've been very fortunate in that I've also gotten a lot of acceptances, but so yeah, it can be a little bit scary. But then, if the editor likes it well enough and wants to go forward with it, then it is very pleasant. I mean, I really, really like working with an editor. I find that it's great when they just tell you something and you're like, oh yeah, that's exactly what I needed to do. That's exactly the way, and I hadn't thought of that before, but that would be perfect. It's fun, and I feel like I've been really lucky with editors, and they've been just great to work with, and it's a fun part of the process. And for me, revision is the most fun of any part of the writing process.
We're visiting with Newbery Honor winning and New York Times best-selling author Margie Preuss. She is out with the new book, The Silver Box. It is the final in the Enchantment Lake mystery series. And Margie, I can't help but notice that this is only one of three new books out this year.
I know it's been a little insane, and it's been a little it's been very strange to have these books come out in the pandemic, during the pandemic, and when everything was shut down, because Village of Scoundrels and The Littlest Voyageur, the two books came out end of February and end of March, when just everything was shutting down and then shut down, and bookstores were closed and libraries closed and Amazon stopped shipping books. And, you know, it was just like everything just went boom. So right when my books came out, so that's been a little rocky. I've tried to up my social media game.
Always
So
fun.
I hope everyone will follow me on Twitter. Yeah, it just happened that way. I mean, publishing is an odd process, and it doesn't mean that I just wrote three books in a year, because I didn't, you know. One of them I recently found a file folder that said, you know, Littlest Voyager 2013, and I think I found one even older than that, you know. So these are stories that that story I've worked on for a long time. So, you know, it just happened that these were the times that they came out.
Yeah, just happened during a pandemic. You know,
Yeah.
authors are somewhat known for being pretty content being at home alone. Has your work life changed really, considering that there is a pandemic?
My work life has not changed. It's just the same as always, which is I have a little writing house in my backyard, and I go out there and turn out or some this time of year, and it snowed a little bit. I guess it snowed where you were too. I build a little fire in my wood stove, and I sit out there and work on my writing or correspondence or a lot of associated business things that you have to do with writing. But what has changed for me is travel, visiting bookstores, visiting schools, speaking at conferences, although I did speak virtually at a conference recently. And so the travel part and the, you know, speaking to groups and speaking to students and things that's really changed.
Who are you reading?
Well, I just had met with my book club last night. We discussed Lilac Girls, which takes place in World War II. I read Hamnet, which is a story about ha Shakespeare's son who died, whose name was Hamnet, and he wrote Hamlet just shortly, like a year or two after that. Boy died of plague, actually, which is a beautiful book. So those are a couple of the books that I just read. I have a big stack on my I'm reading a lot of fairy tales right now because of a writing project, and I just love reading fairy tales. And I'm also reading a lot of mysteries, just because I feel like I it's hard to read. It's hard to read anything very heavy, I think, right now. So I like to get lost in a mystery. I've been reading Louise Penny, and then I'm trying to think of the name of the guy that she said she reads. So I'm sort of reading his stuff too, but I can't think of his name right now. So.
Margie, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun chatting with you.
Ashley Thornburg in a discussion with Duluth author Margie Preuss. You can find out more about her at margiepreuss.com. That's MARGIPREUS.com. Coming up on Main Street, our Friday regulars, Dave Thompson looks at the week's big stories, and Matt Olean reviews a new movie. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. One more step to the possible resolution of a legal dispute over the FM diversion project. After meeting in executive session, the Diversion Authority Board voted 11-2 to approve an agreement to settle the issue with Red River Upstream opponents of the $2.75 billion flood control project. Here's Board Attorney John Shockley.
The motion would be a motion to authorize the executive director and the chair of the Diversion Authority to finalize the negotiations of a binding terms sheet consistent with the parameters that were outlined in the executive session to give them the authorization to do that with any minor changes that they deem necessary.
Details of the terms remain private as the Richland-Wilkin Joint Powers Authority and the Buffalo River Watershed District would have to approve the settlement. The first quarter of fiscal year 2021 was a good one for the North Dakota Mill and Elevator.
With profits totaling $3,282,000, that's a 5% increase from the $3,122,000 profit we had in last year's first quarter.
Mill manager Vance Taylor says the mill shipped about 3.9 million hundredweights of flour in the quarter, up 5% from last year's first quarter.
And that's a new record for the mill for the first quarter.
Taylor says family flour shipments were up 69% in the quarter and organic flour sales were up 43% over last year.
Total wheat purchases in the first quarter was 8,315,000 bushels. That's up substantially from the 7,946,000 bushels of last year.
Taylor says in the second quarter, he expects to see continued strong demand from the mill's customers.
This year's spring wheat and durum crops were of good quality, and our flour is working well for all of our customers out there in the local area and across the country.
The mill is the only state-owned mill in the nation. And the State Human Services Department of Child Care Aware of North Dakota are launching a child care survey. It's being done to assess the impact COVID-19 has had on child care since the state of emergency was declared in March. Kay Larson is with Child Care Aware. She says there are a variety of solutions for child care.
There's just over 1,300 regulated or licensed child care programs in our state. There's Head Start, Early Head Start. There's Department of Public Instruction pre-K programs. There's also some publicly approved after-school programs. And then there's a network of informal care, such as family, friend, and neighbor.
Larson says families are using a patchwork of solutions to deal with child care to meet the needs.
We're interested also in the number of disruptions that the pandemic has caused for families. Stress and other experiences, such as screen time, early education, and child development.
She says Child Care Aware is hoping to share the information with state legislators and other state leaders to look at some solutions to child care issues. Larson says the survey is available at ndchildcare.org or at 1-800-997-8515. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm always glad to learn a new word that I didn't know I needed. And Grant, I learned one from you the other day that I really appreciated.
Was it a four-letter word, a naughty word?
No, it wasn't one of those this time.
I remember, like, my parents saying that it was wrong and that it was ruining the English language because you could replace anything with this word.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
You're moated, corroded, your booty's been exploded.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. There's that old newswire machine. It's time for Dave Thompson and me to talk about the week's big stories because
Absolutely.
Our news director has been on top of it, including some stuff that's just happening.
Exactly.
There's some talk about settlement with the FM diversion with those upstream interests.
Mm-hmm. I guess this has been coagulating for a couple of months now. And there was a vote after an executive session last night by the Diversion Authority to offer a settlement. We're talking about Richland and Wilkin and counties like that. There's no details on it yet, but if this moves forward, that might be a legal hurdle that'll be gone for the diversion project.
Yeah, because they've been starting on it. They're building the dam. They're doing other infrastructure work that's related to the diversion, which, of course, we need to remember was prompted by devastating floods and the potential of flooding all of Fargo-Moorhead.
So, that's correct, yes.
It's a project that a lot of people are keenly interested in.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of support within the Fargo-Moorhead community, but there's been some pushback from upstream residents because they're worried about, you know, the occasional flooding that might happen because of that dam. I know that there's been some give and take on that.
Well,
I think that we'll see what happens.
It's fertile farmland, so obviously it's important to those people who own that property. Let's talk about some more money here from CARES for the state's oil and gas industry.
Right.
CARES Act funding.
Yeah, we have $16 million now that looks like it's going to go to the oil industry for frac crews. Now, you may say, okay, this is CARES Act that is supposed to be, you know, to help with the coronavirus and some of the things that we're facing. And you may say, well, that's kind of odd, but the justification is that you're putting people to work and keeping them in North Dakota. So if and when the oil industry does come back, you don't have to ramp up and go all over the country to find frac crews. And frac crews right now are at a premium in North Dakota.
Well, it's very important to the state's coffers, too, so any oil that comes out of the ground helps the general fund.
Yes, it does. And, you know, we should also mention this because I don't know if you've seen, there's been some thought about the Legacy Fund. Now, the Legacy Fund is funded by oil taxes. There is a group that was based, Jamestown basically seems to be the heart of this. Connie Ova and her development group conducted a statewide survey, and the vast majority of survey recipients said, we should invest the money in the Legacy Fund in North Dakota. That leads to the discussion about using that for infrastructure projects. And they would have to go and get it changed by a vote of the people to add 100% to be invested in the state of North Dakota to the language of the Legacy Bill. I think there's going to be a move to do this. I've been watching it a little bit, and I know there's some support to do this.
Well, when the legislature does convene, there's going to be lots of masks in view, I think.
I think you're right.
The coronavirus is soaring in North Dakota. We had another day of over 1,000 new infections.
Right, and there's been some reporting that the last week or so, North Dakota's led the nation in terms of spiking of cases.
Well, there was also that provocative news headline that if the state were a country, it would have the highest incidence of positive tests in the world.
Right. And the people at the health department and Governor Burgum say one of the reasons we have that is we've been testing a lot of people. And that is very true. We've been doing a lot of testing and we're trying to test people who are asymptomatic. And that turned into an interesting argument a few weeks ago at one of the local county commission meetings in western North Dakota. We had somebody get up to the podium and say, why are you testing asymptomatic people? They're not sick. And I think that's almost counterintuitive because, yeah, they may not be sick, but they can spread the virus. That's a real concern.
That's the interesting wrinkle of this particular bug is
yes.
that it can be passed on by people who have no symptoms.
No symptoms at all, exactly.
Well, let's talk about the debate over masks because Fargo and West Fargo now have okayed mask mandates for those cities, and that was big in the governor's debate, wasn't it?
That was big in the governor's debate. The governor is still talking about he wants personal responsibility because you know, trying to enforce a mask mandate is going to be tough. If you notice, Fargo and West Fargo have mandates, but they haven't included enforcement. Minot did the same thing. Bismarck is resisting. However, Bismarck City employees are now being asked. They're not being asked. They're being told, you come to work, you wear masks in city government. And one of the reasons for that is because some of these people have to deal with the public and they're trying to protect everybody.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting aspects of whether there's a mask mandate or not. It's not so much whether it's enforced. It's that the onus is off the business owner have this debate with everybody who comes in the door. If it's a mask mandate, you need to wear a mask, period.
And that's exactly what the Bismarck-Mandan Chamber said. We need a mask mandate because of that particular thing, because people are coming into stores and saying, I don't have to wear a mask. There's no mandate. You can't force me to wear a mask. The businesses are trying to force them to wear masks. And they said if you had a citywide or statewide mandate, it would make it easier for the businesses to enforce because you could point and say, statewide mandate, you must wear a mask.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a story that Todd McDonald posted about a day ago, University of North Dakota student is asking their peers, how has COVID impacted you? That should be an interesting study.
I think that's going to be a very interesting study. And at the same time, we have a child care association doing a story about what's happened to the child care industry since the pandemic hit and where the needs are. And I think we know that there is a growing need for child care in the state of North Dakota. It'll be interesting. That survey is going to be done through the 1st of November, and this may lead to some legislation.
Well, this student, a master's student at UND, is Shelby Brossert, and she's asking questions like, are you alone? Do you have roommates? Mm-hmm. Do you live on or off campus? How has this affected you financially? How about academically, if you're taking stuff online as opposed to in front of a professor? So there are a lot of stuff here that this has changed.
And, of course, there's psychological things that go along with that, too.
Yeah, sure does. So. Well, continuing the discussion of health and wellness and all that, the North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System has made a decision to stay with Sanford's health plan.
Now, I remember when it dropped Blue Cross Blue Shield in favor of Sanford. That caused a real kerfuffle in that legislative session. That's where the legislators brought up the idea we should go to self-insurance. Well, that's never going to fly at this point. Sanford, there were a few complaints at the beginning, but was talking to the people from PERS who make the decision on that, and they said they've heard very few complaints since that time. So they've been at it for a few years now, and they got another two-year agreement with the option to do a couple more two-years agreement. So, you know, it could be 6 or 8 years before they have to revisit the issue.
Well, an interesting part of this to me is that it's good to have competition. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield and Sanford Health, you know, vying for contracts, that kind of thing. It's also interesting that Sanford has this sort of horizontal and vertical integration, you know.
Right,
They're going everywhere. They provide the service, they provide the insurance, da-da-da.
Right. Now, the insurance, one of the concerns about the insurance early on was that Sanford would not allow like CHI or Essentia or any other health, you know, they wouldn't pay for things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have agreed, and the health insurance is separate from their hospital. There's a wall there, and they will cover your in-network costs.
Well, that's good. And, of course, probably necessary to get
so.
The contract.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about Dickinson State University updating its strategic plan. You reported on that earlier this week.
I think it's extremely interesting that the new president comes in at the same time their five-year strategic plan is expiring. Dr. Easton has some interesting ideas. He wants to have Dickinson State University perhaps go more into online learning. And he's getting a little pushback from some of his faculty because some of the faculty believes that it's best if it's done in person. But he says we need to do that to serve not only college-age students, but students older than average. People who are looking to advance themselves may not go for an advanced degree, but certificate for something else. It's a good way to get people involved. And DSU is the only dual mission university in the system right now. Dual mission meaning you have the, you know, bachelor's degrees and master's degrees and things like that, but you also do things that are more like vocational tech. So that they're involved in that. As a matter of fact, Dickinson State University has just launched a CDL program for commercial driver's licenses. And Dr. Easton said, when he went to what was then called Dickinson Teachers College, they had a CDL program, so things come around.
Well, all of these state colleges or state universities used to be teachers' colleges. In
right.
Not all of them, I shouldn't say that,
but a lot of them did. Yeah.
Normal schools before that. So a two-year education program.
Right,
to
exactly.
Send people out to teach in country schools. Speaking of which, the public school system is really been wrestling with this issue. I mean, in-person classes or online classes. And I think one interesting result of what's happened due to COVID-19 is that snow days may be a thing of the past because you've got a way to instruct.
Yes, that's right, a way to instruct. And that's especially if, you know, you do have a snow day and you can anticipate it, then you say, okay, you'll stay home, you'll get your instruction online. I think that's extremely interesting because there were a few years as I was growing up where we'd have 3 or 4 snow days in a row when blizzards hit. And, you know, you do feel a little bit behind, and then you're playing catch up the rest of the year.
Yeah,
although and I always felt that way.
We certainly enjoyed our snow days.
Yes, we did.
They did not keep us indoors, as I recall. Okay. Todd McDonald had a cool story this week about delivery by drone becoming a reality.
I think that's extremely interesting. And he talked to the people up at Grand Skies in Grand Forks, where they're teaching all this and doing research on drones, unmanned aerial vehicles. It seems to be the wave of the future. They're talking about small deliveries to larger deliveries, and they're also talking about big packages being delivered. I know Amazon's talking about that. Some other firms are talking about that. And you're going to be flying drones instead of trucking a lot of things.
And the state, of course, is on the cutting edge of drone stuff.
Because we've got beyond line of sight, which is very important on developing drones.
So we're likely to see this stuff before most people do elsewhere in the country.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's look forward to it. Keep your eyes on the sky. We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Support for this program is provided by the Moore Family Dakota Paper Component Fund of the FM Area Foundation, a family and business serving the region's communities for over 100 years.
Hey, Prairie Public. I'm Jake Threlkill, host of the Magic City's late night show, Good Night Live.
How's everybody doing tonight?
You know it. You love it. And backed by overwhelmingly popular demand, if businesses had Tinder. You know, Chicago may have had Second City, but we're proud to be North Dakota's third city comedy troupe.
Jake, we're fourth in population.
Nah. Well, good comedy comes from places that have a chip on its shoulder.
Minot's own Dizzy the Clown was recently installed as the president of the International Shrine Clown Association. Dizzy, if you're looking for a side hustle, Minot's looking for a city manager.
So to make up for that supposed tower work in Minot, Prairie Public is sending Main Street's Ashley Thornburg to be a guest on the show.
I work at a nonprofit, so you can definitely afford me.
Good Night Live, Saturday, October 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the original bar and nightclub in Minot. If you want to see the most serious comedy this side of the Mouse River,
Cirrus,
then join us at the original. Tickets and information at goodnightlive.com. It's a big show for a small town.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. And Matt, there's an actual movie out there to go to.
There is, and it's probably the best movie in theaters right now. It's called The Kid Detective, written and directed by Evan Morgan, and it stars Adam Brody from Gilmore Girls fame and Shazam and some other things. Very talented actor. And then Sophie Nelisse, who's a Canadian actress, and it's kind of a film noir. So it's about this kid detective who solves all these little mysteries in town, the town he lives in, and they treat him like royalty. He can solve all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, flash forward, he's an adult and things aren't going quite as well. He doesn't quite have the business he used to have. He's got kind of an odd, quirky secretary. They have some good laughs together. But everything changes when he's approached by a teenage girl whose boyfriend has been murdered. And so, you know, she's not getting help from the police. She goes to him. And he kind of swings into action. So like all film noirs, Doug, it's got that detective and a woman, in this case, a 16-year-old girl. And there's nothing untoward between them in the film. I just want to let people know that. He's hired by her. He's trying to help her. So you've got that man and woman kind of partnership that you always see in film noir, except in a lot of film noir, as you know, the woman ends up being someone not to be trusted. Remember the Maltese Falcon and all those movies, the femme fatale, as we remember them. But this is a quirky little movie. It's funny in parts. The mystery is interesting as they're trying to piece together what happened. There's all kinds of clues. There's all kinds of crumbs that don't lead anywhere. But ultimately, it's a funny movie. It's an interesting movie. And I want to also mention that there's a big tone change in the movie in the third act, and I think they pulled it off pretty well. It's the kind of change in tone, change in feel of a movie that could be very, very abrupt and mishandled. But in this case, you're ready for it, and you're okay with it.
You know, I read a number of reviews about this, and they all pointed that out, that what starts sort of Disney-esque changes a bit. And this writer, director, Evan Morgan, I'd not heard of him before, and this is his first movie?
Yeah, first or second. Not too many films on his resume, but the film has a very clean look to its color. So that's a little bit disconcerting because we're watching a film noir. You think black and white or a little more muddy, but it's very funny in parts, hilarious in fact. The chemistry between Adam Brody and Sophie Nalisse is very, very good. And yes, big, big switch in the third act that is, terrifying, but somehow they pull it off. And I was very impressed how he pulled that off. It's probably not going to win awards, but it's the best film that you can see in a theater right now. And, you know, I know that's not saying a lot because the pickings are very, very slim in theaters right now and will be for a long time. I mean, we were just way off on our predictions, thinking that things might be back to normal by now, and they're clearly not regarding COVID. But this is a film that I think people will enjoy. If you like that kind of thing, these little mysteries, films like Ghost World, you know, come to mind, where there's a teenager and an adult kind of working together on a mystery. So it's a nice little subgenre of kind of the sleuth detective film.
Well, the title threw me for a loop when I first saw it, The Kid Detective. I thought, this is some kid's movie that's out there. Well, it's not a kid's movie. It's a clever movie, I guess, something I look forward to seeing. And when I was looking into it, you described it as sort of a film noir with some comedy in it, which you don't usually think of with film noir.
No.
And so I'm thinking Eddie Muller, on the Turner Classic Movies and stuff like that, because that's his niche, and it's a rich niche. So for our listeners, Matt, what's the proper definition of film noir?
So typically there's a mystery involved. It's typically 1940s and 50s movies shot in black and white. It typically involves a detective or some kind of guy with a past, and often involves a woman that may or may not be attracted to him, might have a secret up her sleeve as well. Look at Double Indemnity. Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck cannot trust each other in that movie. Bogart and Mary Astor in The Maltese Falcon. So that's really, noir means night, as you know. So, the shadows, the lighting in these films was so fascinating. So this film doesn't look like those films, but it does have that mystery, that journey. Where is this journey going to lead Adam Brody and Sophie Nalisse? Is it going to lead to a resolution of things? Is it going to lead to a horrifying secret? We're not sure. And the fact that I could not spot the ending is a testament to the film's quality as well, because you don't want to be able to see an ending coming, and I did not see this ending coming at all. So I like this one a lot. I think it's a film that could do a little business right now, although people are not going to movies very much. But like I said, I think it's the best film that either a grown up or maybe teenagers can see. And you're right, the title suggests, Dean Jones and Haley Mills or something from the 60s, or Kurt Russell when he was making Disney movies, something really, really weird and stupid like that. But it's not that at all. It's very funny, very grown up.
We should mention that there's a famous name in the cast as well. Sarah Sutherland is Kiefer's daughter, Donald's mm-hmm. granddaughter, so the third generation of Sutherlands. And she plays the protagonist, Adam Brody's office assistant, right?
Yeah, she's hilarious. She's absolutely hilarious as his secretary. She's kind of foul-mouthed, and she doesn't really want to do errands for him. And that's a nice – I wish that relationship between – those two would have been a little bit more. Like, I needed one or two more scenes, Doug, because I wanted to see more of her. She's so funny in that part. I wanted to see maybe one or two more scenes with her.
Well, let's move on to the Oscar trivia question, because this is a movie I want to see, and it prompted my search for a good question for you. And I thought, well, what better question than, what was the first film noir to win an Academy Award for performance?
So I'll say Joan Fontaine in Suspicion, 1941.
And just a few years later, another Joan.
Yeah, Joan Crawford for Mildred Pierce, 1945.
All right, so we're celebrating a little film noir. We're going to see one in color called The Kid Detective. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
meet the legendary American maestro Michael Tilson Thomas in an intimate portrait of his amazing life and how he keeps classical music exciting.
Bang! That's how together I want it.
Look for Michael Tilson Thomas on American Masters.
Watch American Masters tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 23rd. On this date in 1940, one of the last North Dakota Railroad pioneers died. Andrew Munson, who was 75 years old, helped build the main line of the Soo Line Railroad in the state. Mr. Munson was born in 1865 in Norway. He came to the United States in 1887 and settled in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The following year, he was hired by the Soo Line. The Soo Line was the nickname for the Minneapolis-St. Paul and Sault Ste. Marie Railway Company. The name Soo, spelled S-O-O, was the phonetic spelling for the first part of Sault Ste. Marie, which was spelled S-A-U-L-T. The Soo Line was incorporated in 1888 and was a consolidation of many different railroad lines that stretched from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to Dakota Territory. Mr. Munson's first job with the Soo Line was as a section laborer in Whitetail, Michigan. In 1890, he was promoted to section foreman. This was when he helped build the main line from Cathay to Portal, North Dakota. The Soo Line reached Portal in 1904. Munson was then promoted to roadmaster, and he moved to Bismarck when the Soo Line acquired the Bismarck, Washburn, and Great Falls Railway. Munson worked for the Soo Line for nearly 50 years, retiring in 1937. Over 100 Soo Line employees attended his retirement party. Mr. Munson was an active and well-respected citizen of Bismarck, a member of the Sons of Norway, the Elks, Modern Woodmen, and the McCabe's Methodist Church. He had 6 children with his wife, Annie. His son, Carl, made front-page news when he met President Woodrow Wilson during his triumphant trip to Brest, France in 1919 after World War I. As one of the last pioneer railroad builders, Mr. Munson's obituary made front-page news next to articles about World War II. The Soo Line, which is now a subsidiary of the Canadian Pacific Railway, still runs through Portal, the line Mr. Munson helped build nearly 120 years ago. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Monday on Main Street, parent-child relationships can be difficult to navigate. They become even more difficult when religious and political views differ. American Gospel is the latest book from author and English professor Lynn Inger. His work explores a complex father-son relationship between Enoch and Peter Bywater after Enoch publicly predicts the apocalypse. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.